Welcome to the AquariMax audio show with Russ and Kelly. We provide information on all kinds of aquarium-related topics.
Episode 94, recorded January 3rd, 2012.
Greetings, everyone.
I said it right. I said 2012.
You did.
Not 2011.
That's pretty good, since the other week you said 2010.
I did.
Yep.
Hey, you know what? We need to save these and make a blooper reel for April 1st.
Oh, there you go. That'd be fun. Good. Well, some of you may remember our New Year's resolution last year on our first January episode, and that was to have one episode weekly or something like that.
An episode every week. An episode in every week.
And if you look at it one way, the pessimistic way, then maybe we failed because we only did... We missed last week, as we predicted we might do and warned you that we might do.
Yes. Well, it was the day after Christmas, and we were out of town.
Yes. It was a bit difficult.
So.
But then, I did remember that we actually recorded 52 episodes, because we had a bonus episode somewhere back in the 70s.
In the 70s
of episodes, not 70s of years. But in episode 70-something.
Was that the bonus episode?
Yeah, bonus episode about Tanked. So we did do 52 episodes in 1 year, so not too bad.
So that's pretty good. Yeah,
that's our first year of doing 52 episodes.
Woohoo!
So thank you for a lovely 2011, because...
It was good. It was a good year for AquariMax.
Yes, it was. So thank you, all of you, for your contributions.
And we're in episode 94 now. We were just saying we're going to cook up something special for episode 100.
Yeah, we're still thinking about what that's going to be.
In the meantime, let's do episode 94.
Indeed.
We are going to hear from Andreka today, and Nigel in the UK, and Roger. Where's Roger at?
I'm not sure where Roger's from.
Roger
An
did
undisclosed
not tell
location.
Okay, mystery Roger.
What? All right. Well, let's talk about Andreka's questions and comments first.
Well, she says, unfortunately, her little shrimp has died.
Yeah, because she had written before and said that he had jumped out of the tank, and I thought that he had survived it, but unfortunately he did not.
She says he was crispy as could be, which is very sad. She did still try to put him in the water, but it didn't. It was too late. She says the tank lid did have a feeder opening.
Yeah, and we were sorry to hear about Shrimpy's demise, but, you know, an attempted revival is...
Never, it can't hurt.
Right, it can be... sometimes a creature can appear somewhat dry and still survive. We've had fish do that once in a while. But when a shrimp is crispy, it's probably crispy. So that's too bad. And, you know, the smallest gap, if they can possibly fit through it, they can find a way, and sometimes
will.
Naughty
little creatures.
That's true.
Let's see. She's also saying they'd had a shrimpy... in the tank with their beta Cassius, and it was a 5 gallon. She says 5 gallon may be bad for these guys unless one is really into the technical side of fish keeping. Cassius got fungus and Shrimpy kept getting out because I think just because she thinks of the water chemistry problems. He never jumped out of the 29 gallon the whole time he was in there for months, but then he kept getting out of the 5 gallon. So
yeah, and I like what Andreka says here about the technical side of fish keeping, because really there are all kinds of fish keepers out there, and some of them really enjoy the micromanaging, if you'll forgive the term, when you have a small tank and you are carefully monitoring and tweaking all sorts of parameters, and you can get some absolutely stunning results that way. I mean, it's possible. In really tiny tanks, they can look marvelous and have perfectly balanced everything, but it takes a lot of effort. You could almost say... those types of tanks take more effort per gallon than a large tank that you just set up to enjoy a community of fish. Larger tanks being more forgiving and stable in general of a lot of things, as we've talked about. There's more wiggle room.
Kind of like the difference between little dogs and big dogs.
Yeah, something like that, maybe. And Andreka also says that now she's just growing Java fern in it, and it could serve as a hospital tank, because she really...
In the 5 gallon?
Yeah. Because she doesn't want to tweak it all the time.
She doesn't want to landscape it so much?
Or just tweaking all the parameters and testing everything as much. And it could be a great hospital tank. Although with certain medicines or things like that, if you're using them, you might need to take the Java fern out, depending on what the medicines you're using. And Java fern is pretty undemanding, but eventually it will need some nutrients. So one thing you could do if you don't want to keep any animal-type livestock, invert or fish, then maybe you could put some comprehensive plant supplement in there once in a while, very small amounts, depending on how the java fern does, because, I mean, they really are tough, but eventually it'll need something. And she also had another question.
Oh, yeah, she wanted to ask about frozen food, like that comes in the little cubes. She says, is it better to bash it up to tiny bits, defrost it, or put it in whole so you can remove the bulk of it should the fish not be interested? And then she says, we have a lot of bottom feeders, 2 growing loaches and about 7 corys, which are all her favorites. And then they've got the gouramis, the danios and Congo tetras as well.
Mm-hmm. And I would say with frozen cube fish food, there are a few things to keep in mind. If you have a fish that's big enough to swallow one of those cubes, that might not be the best thing for a fish to swallow, a frozen cube. But in general,
might give him a tummy ache or what?
It could, potentially.
It's going to get an ice cream headache.
Yeah, there you go. You don't
and
give
you know,
fish
your fish, you can't like blow into your fist if you're a fish to get rid of your ice cream headache.
That's
so
true. It doesn't work. So with most the frozen cube food, though, what I do is I just toss in a cube, or if I'm not sure if the fish are going to eat it all, half a cube.
Mm-hmm.
Just toss it in, and as it defrosts, they'll chew bits off of it.
Okay.
And then if I put a block, you know, half a cube in there, and they eat it really fast, and it's totally gone, then I'll put in the other half. And if they don't really go after it, you know, I can remove it. Or if they eat it, but not, you know, maybe as enthusiastically near the end, then I don't put any more in. And that's a good way to deal with it, I think, in general. There are some frozen foods, like brine shrimp, frozen brine shrimp, for example. If you put it in a container and thaw it, it turns out half of it kind of dissolves into
it's
the water.
It's just all water.
And it's like broth, and the fish can't really get at it because it just sort of goes around and contributes to poor water quality. But if you put it in frozen, they can just kind of gnaw bits off of it. It's not quite as bad. But there are other foods like the frozen mussels that I use for assassin snails,
mm-hmm.
and they really come off in chunks. They don't really dissolve so much, so they're more effective that way. But in general, I just put them in as a block and just be careful to see how much the fish eat.
Just watch them eat it.
Right, and that tells you how much to use, really. You can always add more if they finish it ravenously and immediately, but it's harder to take out if they don't.
Mm-hmm.
But then if it is in a block, you can net it out.
You know what the Mad Hatter says.
You can always take more than nothing.
Can't very well take less.
Exactly. So that kind of depends on what food you're using, but that's my general take on it, I think. And it's interesting that Andreika notices she has developed preferences for certain types of fish,
mm-hmm.
and that's a very natural thing for an aquarist to do. A lot of fish keepers specialize in a particular fish after a time. Some of them don't, some of them generalize, but finding what you gravitate towards is a good way, you know, to eventually maybe specialize in certain things. And you can have a lot of fun with loaches and corys. I mean, there are so many species out there, and they're a lot of fun, yeah. So, there you go. So, thanks, Andreika. Now let's go on to the next one. Who do we have next?
Oh, Nigel, we've heard from our Triops winner.
Yeah, Nigel in, let's see, it's Bridport.
Bridport.
In the UK.
In the UK.
Yeah, and Drake is from Oregon. We forgot to say that, didn't we?
Yes.
Or maybe you said it. I don't know. All right. He says,
oh, okay. This is a fun little note he says here. I have great news from here, as this morning a very shocked-looking postman handed me the parcel from you containing the triop. So after I finished dancing around the hallway and explained what a triops was, so he didn't think I lost the plot completely. Now, I will confess, I don't know what lost the plot means. Maybe that's a British phrase. But I can assume it means that he doesn't think that you're crazy. He says he will start hatching them just after New Year's. He was going to wait until after New Year's so as to not compete with the festivities. We could give it his undivided attention.
And he mentioned that he would keep us updated on the progress and pictures that he takes. And so he may have hatched them already now that New Year's is over.
I guess that's true. It is the 3rd.
Yeah, so he may have, and they don't take very long to hatch.
Mm-hmm.
As long as you keep them warm enough, they'll hatch within just a few hours. So, yeah, let us know, Nigel. Hopefully it goes well. I did mention to Nigel in an email to just use a teaspoon or so of the sand, because we sent enough for several hatchings, and to add some sort of pesticide-free dried plant material to the hatching container, because I forgot to put some detritus in there.
Like what? Like,
well,
leaves or?
Yeah, if you have certain leaves can work. You can use tree leaves like beech. I know that Mick collects beech leaves to use with his cherry shrimp, but as long as you're sure there aren't any pesticides on the leaves, that would be fine. You could use dried coconut husk fiber, sold for use in terrariums. I often use that myself.
And what purpose does it serve?
Well, basically, that material provides food for the infusoria, that then in turn provide food for the very young triops. They don't have that from the outset. They're really too small to eat pellets or whatever, so they don't do very well without the infusoria.
Okay.
But if you include a little bit of that, they tend to do well. That was the most difficult part of hatching triops for me when I first started out.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's easy. I'm used to it. But at first, that balance between making sure you have some infusoria growing but not too many bacteria
is
tricky. So just a little bit. I said maybe, I think I told him, add about a teaspoon of whatever dried plant material he decided to use. And some dried aquarium plants can actually use. You can dry some duckweed or some nectaris or something. Use that.
Okay.
Water Sprite, something like that. Okay.
Let's see. Who do we have next?
This is another question that Andreka had.
Oh, we've got two from Andreka.
Yeah.
Okay. This is about food again. So she says, a couple of weeks ago we bought a new batch of frozen food, particularly because there was a blurb on the window of the display case mentioning primary and secondary foods. I have a feeling we've been feeding our fish secondary food, since after a couple feedings the fish seem to have more color. Would you be interested in going over your recommendations for primary and secondary foods for a standard average setup?
Okay, and then she's got another question about bubbles, but we'll talk about this food question for a little while. Now, the use of primary and secondary foods...
Tell us what a primary and secondary food is.
Well, I'm actually a bit intrigued by this, because I don't know that these are universally used terms by all aquarists.
So you haven't really heard these terms so much?
Not so much. I mean, I know about primary and secondary consumers, and this may relate to the trophic pyramid, and it may not. I'm not sure where exactly this comes from, but I have a few ideas about where it may be going. But I did. There are a lot of concepts out here that might be related to this, so I'll explore a couple of those a little bit. One term that I've heard that may be connected to this is staple versus supplementary foods. For example, years ago this was more true than it is now, but you could, at the time, buy color foods, and the purpose of these foods was mainly just to improve the coloration of fish. And they were not intended to be nutritionally complete foods. They were just a supplementary part of the diet. You were to vary them with your staple food flakes. And if you were to feed them as a primary food and not, you know, give a lot of other foods as variety, the fish would not have a balanced diet. That sense be less true now. Most color foods that are on the market today are color enhancers added to a more or less nutritionally complete diet. So the staple versus supplementary could be primary versus secondary. It may be referring to this. I would actually be interested, Andreka, if you could mention which brand you're talking about you noticed on this display case, and then I could look into it a bit further, because I did do a little bit of research to see, but I didn't find anything on that particularly, so you'd let us know about that. Another issue, though, that may relate to this is that fish tend to be omnivorous, especially in aquaria. A herbivorous fish will not turn up its nose at a tasty morsel made of meat, and vice versa. You know, a carnivore will sometimes nibble on plants and so on. And then there are plenty of fish that are true omnivores and are, you know, happy to eat both plant and animal material. But most foods that are served in dry form, like flakes and pellets and granules and crumbles and crisps and all those sorts of things, well, I shouldn't say most, but many of them have starches in them. They are full of
that fish would not
wheat
eat.
Meal or cornmeal or things like
know.
That.
Oh, okay. There's my soapbox. I don't know if I should get on it right now.
Oh, well, you can jump on and jump back off.
I'll just jump. I'll put one foot up. How about that? Why is it that pet food companies do this? They have an animal and who would not normally eat these grains, and yet they insist on filling their food full of it. It's so hard to find dog food or cat food that actually has ingredients in it that a cat, any dog, should actually eat.
In the wild.
And, yeah. And
so to speak.
why is there cornmeal in fish food? Fish, how many fish are growing their own corn in their little kelpy backyard thinking, oh boy, I'm gonna dry that and pop it and watch a movie. They don't eat corn.
No, most fish do not.
What's their deal?
Well, I'll tell you the reasons.
Tell me the reasons. I'm attempting to step back off my soapbox now.
No, I was actually glad you got on the soapbox because it applies equally to fish as it does to cats or dogs. It's the same deal.
It's a very silly thing.
One reason is they're cheap.
That's the lamest reason ever.
Well, yeah, but it's true. It's easy to get cornmeal or wheatmeal or wheat flour and these things. They're really cheap. Fillers. They add bulk. Mm-hmm. So
it looks like you're buying more.
You're buying more, yeah, in terms of weight or quantity. Mm-hmm. And they help bind the food. They make it stick together. Mm-hmm. Those are some good reasons. Well, there are some reasons why those are in there.
There are some corporate reasons.
And it is important to have food that stays together and doesn't just dissolve when it hits the water, and that's important, and so on. But a lot of these starches aren't particularly well digested by fish, and they do need some bulk and to go through their system. If there's no bulk at all, it's difficult to move through their system, so
you
that's
can
important
get that
too.
With vegetation.
And vegetation is another way to do that as well, that's true. But fish digestive systems in general, and this is not true for all species, but in general, they're not particularly equipped to digest large amounts of carbohydrates, because in their diets they're digesting lipids, proteins, things like that. Those are more of what they're into. And then they get roughage from plant material, and they get roughage from chitin, which is, the exoskeleton material in shrimp and insects
and so
on. So
when they snag a bug or a shrimp.
Right, and that qualifies as roughage in their diets. So it's not all that natural, but at the same time, fish do fairly well on it. You can give fish with wheat meal or cornmeal in it, and they do just fine. They can grow up, and a mini fish can grow and live and thrive on those foods because they also contain these other nutrients and so on. So that's something to bear in mind. But it's true that the more natural foods, like frozen foods that are made out of things they would actually eat in the wild, or closer to what they would actually eat in the wild, do often seem to promote certain health benefits. There's debate on this. There are people who will say that prepared foods are all your fish need, and it's true that prepared foods are improving, and they have improved a lot since
they first came out. They could probably just make like protein and nutritional shakes that people could survive on, but
it's not necessarily fun.
It's not,
yeah, but there are foods out these days that are amazing compared to what we used to have to put up with even 10-15 years ago. They've made immense improvements in prepared foods. But a variety of foods are good. Fresh foods seem to be good. There are some fish that simply will not thrive on dry food.
Oh, we forgot to take a break.
Oh, well, we better
take it now. This isn't a commercial, because it's not trying to sell you anything. It is, however, the part where we shamelessly encourage you to be a part of the Aquarimax audio show by calling and leaving a message any time of the day or night at 801-477-0629. If you don't want to actually talk, but you do have a comment or question, you can just send us an email to info@aquarimax.com. There. That wasn't so painful now, was it?
Well, so to sum up this discussion on foods, I guess, there are a lot of foods out there that contain these fillers, the grain fillers and so on, that may not be the most natural food for fish, but they are cheap and fish generally do okay on them. There are fresh foods that are more closely approximate their natural foods, such as frozen foods specifically, and that there are fish that even without live foods, they just won't thrive or they won't breed. Because one of the reasons, at least, this is true is because in spawning season, typically what happens is there is an influx of fresh water from upstream in the form of either rainwater or snowmelt comes in. and it often washes a whole bunch of insects and things like that into the body of water where the fish are. And so this is part of the process of conditioning them for breeding. And so you sometimes need to simulate that by introducing live food. And so it seems to me that if that is the case, that it must be healthier for them to have live food or frozen food or something like that, at least sometimes, than just dry food. But I would be interested, Andreka, again, in finding out more about the primary and secondary foods that you mentioned in terms of which brand or which manufacturer was promoting that and what they said about it. Okay, the final question that Andreka had was about the teeny bubbles.
Bubbles! Always makes me want to quote the fish from Nemo.
Yes.
Bubbles, 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 my bubbles. Okay. Alrighty, so she says that since her last water change and rearranging of the tank, that there are lots of teeny tiny bubbles coming up from the bottom. And she says, we have bottom feeders who remain there active as usual. Don't know if I'm just noticing the bubbles for the first time. Any thoughts?
Okay. Well, bubbles could mean a lot of things. And it does help that you mentioned that they were teeny tiny bubbles and that they were coming up after water change and after rearranging the tank. Well, still, it could be a number of factors, but let's see what it is. Okay. When you mentioned that teeny bubbles were coming after water change, that suggests that it could just be simple outgassing, which is nothing to be concerned about in moderation. Basically, the water from the tap contains a lot of dissolved gases most of the time. The water's under pressure. And once they get into the aquarium, the pressure lessens, and so they come out. They nucleate. They make little bubbles all over things. And if you do a very large water change, like more than 50%, even if you treat the water for chlorine and chloramine and temperature is okay and so on, can sometimes, depending on the water and the fish and so on, you can get a lot of outgassing and bubbles will start to form on the outsides of fish. And I've noticed this in large water changes, like maybe 80% or so on, which I try not to do too often, you know, without a reservoir of water that's already outgassed. But this can form bubbles both on the inside of the fish, which you can imagine is something like humans getting the bends, with the nitrogen bubbles forming in their blood and things like that. And it is something like that. And so that can be bad. But for smaller water changes, you do get some bubble formation often. But it's no cause for worry as long as it's not. You don't see your fish covered in bubbles and they don't seem to be stressed. It's usually fine. And with a change under 50%, you probably won't get a significant number of bubbles that would cause any issues. If this is what is happening, you'll see this bubble formation pretty soon after the water change, and it should dissipate within a few hours. So if that's what's happening, no worries, unless it's a really excessive water change and you're getting fish with gas bubble disease. Now, if air bubbles are being reintroduced into the water from your filtration system, like you have a venturi on a power head, something like that, the venturi is basically just a device that sucks water from the air and pulls it down into the filter and then squirts it out in the form of tiny bubbles in a power head or something like that, then you'll get a number of small bubbles in the aquarium all the time. And again, that's nothing to worry about. It's a good way to aerate the tank to some degree, as long as they're not present on the bodies of the fish in large numbers, things like that. If, on the other hand, the bubbles are actually coming from the substrate and just the substrate, there could be a couple of issues. Could be, possibly, hydrogen sulfide, which can form in cases where there's low to little oxygen and there's bacterial action working on substances in the substrate that can be bad. Hydrogen sulfide is pretty toxic to fish. But if everybody seems okay in the tank, probably okay, but it's hard to tell, really, with hydrogen sulfide what's exactly going on. If your substrate is fairly deep or if it hasn't been vacuumed for a while or if there's more waste has been ending up in the substrate than usual, this might be something you should consider as a possibility. And it is quite toxic, and one thing to do if you suspect that is to vacuum a small amount of gravel at a time, but thoroughly, over a course of several days, so you're not doing too much at once, because a very small amount of that hydrogen sulfide can be toxic. Very toxic. It could conceivably be nitrogen outgassing too. It's possible. I mean, I don't think that usually shows up as visible bubbles, to my knowledge. But if you have a deep substrate with low oxygen, again, there are certain bacteria that will act on nitrates and release it as nitrogen gas. But I would be surprised that it would be in visible bubble form. there. So that kind of bacterial action can be beneficial because it removes nitrates from the water, though. And it's possible, I guess, that that's... I got to admit, I don't know if that occurs in visible bubble form very much or not. So there's some possibilities, but I'm kind of betting on the first one. So let us know if it's that, if fits the profile of what we just explained, if it's just a little bit of outgassing from the water under pressure.
Hopefully
after
that's
water
all it
change.
Was. Mm-hmm. Okay, we have one more today from Roger. Roger's new, right?
I think so, yeah. I don't think
he's,
Roger
he's
has
contributed
Roger, yet.
He's Mystery Roger because we don't know where
yes.
he's at.
So welcome, Roger.
Okay. He says, "Hi, I'm building a 12 by 18 foot fish house, and although I have a pretty good idea of what I want to do, I'd like to hear what you think would be the basic, fundamental, have-to-do elements of this project. I'm also looking for suggestions on shelving. Most of what I have found is ugly and or not sturdy enough."
Okay, well, thanks, Roger.
That is a groovy project.
It is. That's cool that you have the resources to be able to build a fish house. It looks like one fairly spacious one. That'll be fun. I, myself, have had rooms housing a number of aquaria, so I guess you could call them fish rooms. Had them. But I've never actually built one. And I suppose that I've done some research in the area, and I know a few things to be aware of, like, you know, thinking about moisture barriers and a little bit about the electrical wiring that you have to be aware of and things like that, and whether you're going to do a system where all the tanks are connected or not, and some things to be aware of there. But I
Russ's,
would really...
Russ's dream is to have one where they're kind of all connected and all he has to do is push a button to kind of flush them and change the water.
But I would have everything hooked up to UV, you know,
yeah.
that too. Okay. But I'd really like to turn this over to our listeners who have done it. I'm sure we have listeners out there who have built their own fish rooms.
We have not as yet had the opportunity to do that because we've always been renting, so we can't really build anything where we're living, so...
Right. But if you... Maybe if you've done that, or even just converted a room to a fish room completely, you know, redone the walls and all those sorts of things, that could be useful too. Then maybe you could send us a list of fundamental features to include in a fish
or
room.
Or if they would be willing to do an interview, we could have a guest interview.
And that would be great, too. So if mm-hmm. you have any comments, either via interview or just via email, or you want to call in and leave a message.
Or Facebook.
Anything like that. And you'd be interested in doing that for us. We would love it, and I'm sure Roger would, too. Because I just don't feel like I can contribute a whole lot in never having built one, but I'm sure Roger would appreciate anything that you could send him in terms of that. So we'll go from there.
Oh, we do have one more thing, huh? No, oh, two more things. Ha ha. See, I'm so organized. But I know what year it is.
You do.
I do know
true.
What year it is.
Well,
at least
so thanks.
Right now.
Thanks, Roger. I forgot to say that, so I'll say it now.
Oh, okay. See, you're organized too. Okay, we have a Christmas arrival.
We do. We mentioned, I think, before that our daughter wanted to get a betta for Christmas.
She wanted her own tank in her room.
So we set up a spare 20-gallon tank, and she received a heater for Christmas.
From Santa Claus.
And after Christmas, we hooked up the heater and made sure that everything was working. I had used one of my heaters in the tank in the interim. She cycled it over several weeks, and just a couple of days ago, 4 days ago or so, she got a new betta.
And I have never seen a 5-year-old so excited about getting a fish.
She was stoked.
This was the situation. We had actually just gotten back that day from our trip. We'd driven all day Thursday and a good part of Friday, got home, and she couldn't wait until Saturday to go get the fish. Russ had to take her Friday afternoon after we got back and were totally shell-shocked from driving and everything. She's like, "I gotta go get my fish!"
And
she
so
was so excited.
We decided to give in, I guess, and we went down to the pet mm-hmm. store and got her a fish. Now, this betta was a nice betta. It's a half
pretty.
Moon. A half moon butterfly. It's got kind of a red, mostly red body, right?
Well, it's red and blue, but not like
not
mushed,
purple.
Like alternating.
And then its fins, the butterflying on the fins mm-hmm. is blue, right? Are mostly blue?
Blue and red on the fins.
On the fins, too?
Yeah, I don't remember now looking at it.
Because the body's much...
Which one's on the outside and
Well, on the fins, I think maybe the body is the same color as the outside of the fins, and then there's red all around.
We'll put a picture up for you. We can't go check it right now because she's asleep.
Right, but it's a nice-looking fish. I mean, I'm sure it wouldn't win in the show.
He's a handsome boy.
But it's a nice-looking fish. It only costs us about $10, mm-hmm. which I think is worth it for a nice-looking fish like that. And I'll try to put a picture up on the resources page. You can take a look.
Mm-hmm.
Hard to get a picture of this one. It's kind of a shy betta compared to some others, but it's a warm fish.
He's starting to recognize her as the food source now. She's very excited.
And darting up to the surface when she comes to feed it. It's
fun to see the younger generation excited about fish.
Indeed. We also had a little visit to McLeod's Pet Emporium when we were out in California. And we interviewed, kind of an impromptu interview of one of the employees
there. It's not recorded.
We talked to them about it. About the electric blue crayfish that they have. They don't not only keep them, but they breed them there on site,
yeah.
And then they sell them. And so we talked to them a little bit about that. And
they were really pretty striking.
Yeah, they're very
really bright.
Rich blue. And they said that the males sell for about $20 and the females for a couple hundred.
$300. And we kind of went, whoa!
Yeah, and they said that the breeding them is fairly easy. When you have to put the males and the females together at the right time. But if you do that, the female will just carry the eggs and then release them as fully formed, non-larval young. The juveniles, they're like fully formed, tiny little crayfish.
And you said they have several hundred babies at once, right? Which is why the females are so expensive, because really you're buying
the potential to produce a lot of crabs,
crayfish, yeah.
Right. And the species, if I looked into it, it's Procambrus alleni. So if you want to look that up and find out a little bit more about them, that could be fun. I'll put a link on the resources page. And I took some video and a few stills, so we'll put that up too so you can check that out. Kind of fun to see. And I think that about wraps it up for this week.
So have a fishy year.
Yeah, I hope you have a happy, very piscine-infested New Year. Thank you for listening to this edition of the Aquarimax Audio Show. For additional episodes, please visit aquarimax.com. For comments and or questions that may be featured on an upcoming podcast, leave a message at 801-477-0629 or email us at info@aquarimax.com.